Thank you. Okay. There's lots of jargon in phonetics and phonology. Jargon can be very intimidating, and I think a lot of the jargon can actually make it so that you lose or obscure information. In this talk, I'd like to cover a few things. A technique for motivating the use of some jargon to get people excited about using some of this linguistics jargon, whether it's called linguistics jargon or not. A few simple ways to teach sounds, and then a discussion about teaching or discussing the allophone-phoneme distinction. Most of this talk comes from experiences I've had working in Breath of Life in Oklahoma, working with Cherokee Nation, and also teaching general linguistics to people who don't have any linguistics backgrounds. So, covering motivational work, how do you motivate people to learn the labels or the jargon for linguistics? And what I'd like to do is prevent a little technique for motivating language teachers or language learners to buy in and see the need for at least some phonetics jargon in terms of studying and talking about sounds. The purpose of this exercise is to get participants to buy into some of the jargon necessary for giving clear, concise descriptions to sounds, to get them to buy into the labels for the vocal tract in particular. So it works like this. You have a number of people participating, break them into small groups, model an explanation for a sound in a very general terms, like, okay, let's talk about sounds. Let's talk about the sound P. Let's talk about the sound P. P is a quiet sound. It's made by closing the lips and stopping air from coming out of the mouth, like a-pa. Try it out, pa, pa, a-pa, and so on. And then you ask the groups, you say, okay, I'd like you guys to work on describing sounds in a similar way. Let's try with T, K, B, D, G, M, N, N, G, and so on. So you get the groups working on coming up with descriptions of different sounds. They share the descriptions, you work on putting those key ideas, important ideas from people on the board, praising all of the good contributions, and then discuss the results. Usually it works out in one of two ways. The first way, someone comes up and the group says, oh, well, T is an unvoiced sound that stops air by placing the tip of the tongue just behind the teeth. And you say, fantastic, you've learned everything you need to know, let's move on to something else, and this is great. Typically, what I find is that something else happens. You get a group that comes up and says, T is a quiet sound, it stops air from coming out of the mouth by touching the tongue to the roof of the mouth. And you're saying, okay, this is really good. And then the next group comes on and describes K in exactly the same way. And this is wonderful because you get to say, hey, so is this an issue? Can we talk about this? And if you ask participants, they say, yeah, this is an issue. And you know what? We could solve this if we just said that there are different parts of the mouth and different parts of the tongue that are used in talking. They come up with this idea, of course, on their own with maybe a small amount of guidance. Depending on the language you're working on, you can guide them towards different distinctions that might be necessary. When you guide them towards those, it's not say, oh, and make sure that you talk about the hard palate. No, it's here's a contrast of sounds, here's a minimal pair. How do we make this distinction? And let them provide the labels and the distinctions that are necessary to the extent possible. You've gone through this point, motivated the idea that there are different parts of the mouth, the tongue. People have come up with this idea on their own, they're excited about it, and you say, okay, well, let's look at something like a mid-sagittal section. You don't call it that, you use latifoged sidehead Sammy. Something nice and simple and clean, like this. What I think is a mistake to do at this point would be to introduce something that has lots of labels and details, and the idea is we're not going for comprehensive, exhaustive description of the vocal tract, we're aiming for the bare essentials, the elements that are clear and easy to motivate in terms of distinguishing sounds. You just want what's simple, right? And there's, I think, a real difference there. So having had participants work through an exercise like this, I think it helps them see the value in developing and using some jargon on their own. For me, the little bit of jargon like this can help make descriptions of sounds very precise. And I think it also helps motivate the use of jargon in the future. So it makes people more willing to learn, to teach, to work with, to include in their own work useful jargon in the future. For the linguist, I think it's important to allow the community to develop their own jargon and to learn to work with the jargon that the community develops. So for us, in our research, we might have to provide a key for, Chris, I gave myself an extra 3 minutes because we had technical issues at the start, but thank you. providing a key to that community jargon for other linguists is important when we're doing our linguistic research. But the general rule is linguistic work can use linguistics jargon, but work with the community uses the jargon from that community that they've helped develop on their own. So having discussed this idea of how to teach essential jargon, I'd like to talk now about teaching specific sounds. I think many of us work in areas where English is sort of the dominant language. Even if it's Spanish or Chinese or something else, there's a dominant language, and we can make use of that language and its allophones. Its sounds and the allophones that are contained in it. And I think that once we have a very simple jargon for the vocal tract, we can provide really simple explanations for sounds without resorting to the technical jargon from your course in phonetics textbooks. To teach sounds, you only need a few tools. You need this a minimum of jargon that we just motivated in the previous exercise. And it's very helpful to be able to teach the voiced-voiceless distinction if that's something that's relevant for the language you're working on. It's not possible to cover all of the sounds in the IPA chart, for example, with such a simplified system, but you can get close and you can make a lot of work, a lot of progress. What I'd like to do for the rest of this subsection is talk about, give two illustrations of how to teach sounds. One using allophones from a language from English, and then an illustration of how to teach other sounds with just that minimum of jargon that we motivated. So English has aspirated voiceless aspirated stops and voice stops. It doesn't do so well in the palatal sound department, but we do have allophones, palatal allophone in English. The classic example would be something like comparing key and car, right? And straight out of Latifoget course in phonetics. If you say compare key and car and listen to the sounds, one's palatal in key and it's velar in car, that doesn't get you much. But if what you're trying to do is get the idea that they're different sounds, I think it becomes really clear to people when you say this. Start to say key. Get halfway through and switch to car. Kyar. Now do the other. Say car. Car. And start to say car. And then switch to key. Kai. You get really different things. People laugh. It's fun. It's funny. And they start to get that intuition. Hey, these are different sounds. There is something different going on here. And that starts getting people access to intuitions about sound that they've worked all their lives to ignore, right, in working with English. So a palatal sound can be taught in a way like this using allophones from English. You can talk about the voice onset time, difference in aspiration, voiceless unaspirated sounds. Classic examples like, say, sparrow. Try to remove the S, sparrow, 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 barrel, barrel, barrel. When I do this in most of my work, it ends up being sparrow, sparrow, paro, paro, and it doesn't work at all. But that's okay, because there are other ways to get at this. It turns out that in English, the voiced stops, BDG, at the beginning of words, after a pause, right, are essentially voiceless, unaspirated stops. So when you say big, dig, gig, that first sound, bih, is not, right? It's not really voiced all the way throughout. It's the voicing starts right afterwards. This is, for all intents and purposes, a voiceless unaspirated stop. You can get through and get people intuitions to these sort of sounds using the allophones of a language. Sometimes you don't have allophones, so you have to come up with your own descriptions. One way to do this would be to say something like, well, what's a retroflex sound? If you've got a minimum of jargon, you can do this without sounding like a linguistics textbook by saying, well, look, right, take that underside of the tip of your tongue and put it just behind your teeth, where the flesh of the top of your mouth is getting really close to your teeth, and make a sound there and say, ata, 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 ada, ada, ada. really easy, really clear, and we have lost almost nothing compared to what the description would be in a traditional textbook. Teaching sounds is important. It makes hearing descriptions of sounds much easier to understand. It makes it much easier for others to incorporate to the teaching of sounds into their classroom if they're teachers. And I think it helps people to learn how to model sounds, to learn how to describe them in precise detail without having to resort to the phonetics jargon when you say voiceless bilabial fricative and people sort of turn off their ears, right? At this point, I've discussed a way of motivating a small amount of essential jargon. I've described a few sounds with very little linguistic jargon using with reference to allophones in English or to just the vocabulary, the basic vocabulary we motivated. And what I'd like to talk about next is how it can be useful to discuss a phoneme-allophone distinction without ever saying things like phoneme and allophone. So a phoneme-allophone distinction could start with definitions from a textbook. And it would end up reading from the allophone. The allophones of a phoneme form a set of sounds that, one, don't change the meaning of a word, two, are very similar to one another, and three, occur in phonetic contexts that are different. In a revitalization context, that's never going to be helpful. You turn, you know, everyone closes their ears, and they're done. So if explaining the definitions of these things isn't useful, why would it be useful to ever talk about a phoneme-allophone distinction at all? And I think the idea is if you're aiming for something like a L1-like pronunciation, you need to be able to produce and pronounce all of the sounds in a language. You have to know how those sounds vary in different environments, and that's exactly what the phoneme-allophone distinction is about. So how do we teach phoneme or allophone? I think the idea is that we give very general definitions, discuss some properties of L1 interference, and then provide lots of concrete examples. I'd like to, when I do this sort of thing, I like to add a note about L1 interference, not in those terms, of course, but English speakers, for example, have spent their entire lives practicing how to ignore things like nasal vowels, long and short vowels, and aspiration. And when you learn a new language, you have to learn to suddenly pay attention to some of these details sometimes. And that's hard. You're going against a lifetime of training. Letting people know that they're going against a lifetime of training can sometimes be very liberating and motivating in terms of taking on an endeavor of learning another language. So I think that this is something that also can help in terms of motivation and preparing people for the challenge that's ahead of them. So what are our de-jargons definitions of phoneme and allophone? Well, what is a phoneme? A phoneme is a sound that can change the meaning of a word, right? So a sound is something that can change the meaning. A sound is something that can change the meaning of a word. And people are very receptive to this as an idea. Oh, of course, yeah. And you give a few examples with minimal pairs, and it's very clear. The other idea that people are very happy to accept is this idea that in a language, certain sounds might be pronounced differently based on where they appear in a word. And that's exactly what an allophone is. So without getting into any technical descriptions at all, you've given the concept that constitutes an entire semester's study in something called phonology, right? A sound can change the meaning of a word, and language sounds may be pronounced differently based on where they appear in a word. So we've discussed this general broad definitions, a little bit about interference from a first language, and you've mentioned the idea that some sounds might be important to one language, but not necessarily to another. At this point, it's good to look at examples. For example, what about long and short vowels? Vowels, the duration of a vowel. Osage, as an example, has a word weli, which means head, versus weli, which means oil. It really matters. This difference really matters. Many languages have this difference. English? Well, in English, we have words like see and seat. The duration of the vowels is really different. People can usually hear that difference between see and seat. And you can say, yeah, in English, we have these differences too. But you know what? There's a rule to explain them. you get vowels that get shortened a lot when they're in a syllable that ends in P, T, K, F, all of these quiet sounds, and the voiceless sounds, depending on how much jargon you've motivated in that first section. Nasal vowels, oral vowels, again, to go back to Osage, you can say hapa and mean corn, or you can say hapa and mean day. Ha versus ha. This is a crucial difference in changing the meaning of words. And in English, we can say things like tom and tot, and we're doing the same thing, but it's not something that is systematic. You start to say tom and you end up with ta. You start to say tot and you end up with ta. And you can get people to hear this difference, ta, ta. And they can recognize and say, oh yeah, hey, I know that, I do that. And now it's a little bit easier to get to hapa and hapa when you're working on Osage, for example. We can do this with other distinctions like aspiration. English does the same thing, but because we had a few technical difficulties at the beginning, I'll skip through that and get to the conclusions. The main conclusions for this talk, and I think the other sessions in this, the other talks in this session, are that linguistic jargon, the label of a concept in particular, is not as important as the concept itself. So we encourage the active de-jargoning of linguistic material in a teaching pedagogical context. Presenting accessible and learnable materials is more important than presenting the technically correct, jargon-rich, elegant linguistic analyses that we're used to carrying out from grad school and beyond. And I think it's a fair trade-off to give up just a small amount of precision and technical detail to get into making things more usable and accessible in language learning environments. And I think teaching concept versus jargon and labels is important. If people do go on to study linguistics or to have to interact with the literature, when you read about a concept and get the label, if you've already mastered the concept, perhaps in different terms, learning the label is something that is very trivial, very easy. And with that, I will say mahalo, and thank you very much for coming to the session. Does anyone have, yeah?
Are there any specific terms you find that you want to avoid at all costs, or they just never work?
There are challenges. I'm struggling right now to think up the concrete examples because my focus has been on what works so far. I think the biggest challenges for me are if I'm going into something like this unprepared and I get asked about something and I haven't thought through how to translate a jargon-rich part of phonetics or phonology into just its intuitions or the core concepts, it's always challenging the first few times through. And that could be for any term that I just haven't thought of before. I can't think, syllables for me have always been tough. I've invariably had people who have trouble saying, well, wait a minute, what about a syllable this, what about that? And trying to come up with a clear, quick description has been something that has so far eluded me. But I'd be very happy to get suggestions on how to do that better. This comes, for me, this is based on experience that I've had working in Breath of Life. So working with a lot of people who are language learners and possibly going back to communities as teachers. And also, a lot of this comes from teaching general linguistics to people who are encountering linguistics for the first time. It's required by, it's a general ed course where I am. So we get people who have no intent or interest in linguistics. Going forward, so trying to convey things in ways that disinterested people might be willing to follow and pay attention to has been part of that as well. So yeah, the audience is varied. for teachers, I think this is the most important thing to get across, to motivate things. For people who are language learners, there's a lot of language learning work that they have to do. So all of this helps, but I think this is best aimed at teachers, or that's the ideal audience in my mind. Yeah. Yes?
Another question, so much as a contribution. I fulfill pretty much exactly the same role as you in another context. With the phone and allophone distinction, I found the analogy of different coins and different faces of the same coin works really well. The other thing I've learned is, however I explain these things to my students who are teachers, is that's exactly what they are.
Yeah, that's what gets passed on.
In their classroom, so how you explain it is exactly what your lessons get re-delivered to other group of students.
Thank you, yeah.
I work in a totally different context where it's very jargon rich, where English is not the majority language.
Yeah.
And so we have to come up with ways to de-jargon it for the teaching of the minority languages, because they're not going to understand the Russian jargon applied to the minority languages. And so it was very interesting to listen to you trying to go the other way, whereas I have to go the reverse way, but it's still the same things still apply. Thank you for sharing this.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. I think one of the things that I had fun with this past fall was trying to read in the education literature. I got this slide up. There's something called assisted discovery learning in the education literature, which basically involves having a teacher lead a group of students through material so that they will learn the material without the teacher delivering a lecture on it. I learned that in meta-studies of teaching efficacy, this is considered one of the most effective methodologies, and that's exactly what all of this, plus some of the things that my co-presenters will be discussing later on today, follow this pattern. So it's sort of encouraging to know that, you know, the people who have actually studied all this stuff have already know about these sort of things, of course, and have deemed this particularly effective. One thing that I also discovered was that there's something called discovery learning. So there's assisted discovery learning, good. Discovery learning, controversial. Discovery learning has a bad name because for a long time when it was studied, it was essentially put people in a room, let them discover stuff. No guidance, zero guidance. And that apparently turns out to be a very ineffective way in many cases to teach things. So the core thing is when people are working through processes like these and learning things for themselves and being guided and helped to learn them and discover them, they really take ownership of the material in a way that people don't from a lecture where you say, here's the term and I will define it, and now I move on, another term, I will define it. Then of course, if you take it too far and just say, okay, go discover stuff, that's also not very good. So it's the sweet medium of guided, assisted discovery learning that seems to be really crucial. So I appreciate hearing other comments like that. Sounds like we've got we're out of time, and we'll have to get set up for the next talk. Thank you very much.